God, I don't know if I could even find anything in this. I'm looking at the selected poems. It doesn't have very many.
But nothing really comes to mind. But you're saying that the lesson here is you find a writer that you like, write like them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's what you're saying.
Imitate him like crazy. Yeah. And then find another one and imitate him like crazy, right?
Why is that?
Look at this. The gold ring minted for your finger is fitted there now as part of your household hours. And your eyes of light tears when you looked at me, your husband, are part of me too. I thought, wow, look at the page. Look at this, radio people.
Poem for my wife, Angela, for those of you not able to see that.
That was a poem from, that would be from, I don't know, 1961 or something like that. Or 62, whatever.
So reading... And, you know, I'm going to skip right over Pound. Mm-hmm. I'm more interested in Williams, but Pound is obviously a huge person. The ABC of Reading, you're saying, is one of the most important books.
Yeah, and I still haven't exhausted. I'm never going to exhaust the cantos, right? But
are they inexhaustible?
I think so. I hope so, which is peculiar because, you know, he wrote them in 50 years. And he was doing other stuff too, but then so are we.
Right.
But, they are inexhaustible. But, no, it wasn't just that either because... His essays, not just me, a whole bunch of us were like tremendously interested in his essays. His essays about like the area in Europe where medieval poetry was becoming Renaissance poetry, right? Which he calls romance, is like that. We were tremendously interested in his working on that. Partly, I suppose, because we saw him as a role model. Here we were feeling guilty about being university student poets. And here is Williams going way past his American professors in his study of the sources of literature, right? Like he couldn't find a university in the United States where he could take courses on the stuff he was interested in, because nobody was giving courses on it, right? So he became his own, as they said, eduversity.
We're talking with George Bowering at the Victoria School of Writing Summer Session. The session is over for the 10th time. It's the 10th anniversary this year, 2005. I'm Paul Nelson. Reading Pound and Williams prepared you for the postmodern movement in literature. Those mm-hmm. are the two guys behind it. What was it about postmodern open form that appealed to you?
Oh, I think if you read the stuff that William Carruth Williams says about the sonnet, for instance, Williams related writing a contemporary poetry different from old-fashioned closed verses and forms like sonnets and so forth. He compared that with writing, looking for an American idiom as opposed to writing more British poetry. And there were lots and lots of American poets writing. This was the argument that was there in the 19th century in the U.S. as well, right? You had all those guys up in Boston writing as if American poetry was a branch of British poetry. And you had a few people who were saying, no, that ain't true, like Poe and Whitman. Poe, they recognize that. You go back to Europe now, and you go to graduate schools in their universities where they're studying like North American literature, and they know what's good, and they go straight to Poe, right? He's got a picture in a lot of the United States as a guy that wrote some scary stories and a thing about a raven, right? But they know. And then you go back and read William Carruth Williams's piece about Poe in The American Grain, and you'll see that Williams understands what those European guys are talking about too. So it's very ironic about Williams saying we got to write in the American idiom as opposed to those inherited forms that we got from England. But Williams knows everything that's going on in Europe, not England. He doesn't pay much attention to England, but he knows what's happening in not only in literature, but in science and everything else, and politics and so forth, in France and Germany and Italy and so forth, right?
Yeah. And the English didn't care much about him until Charles Tomlinson came around. So
that's right. After a while, and it's so funny because they always called him Carlos Williams. He used to bug me, right? But that's just an English habit.
The 1963 Vancouver Poetry Conference was a seminal event in postmodern North American poetry. Can you tell us about how that event happened and some of your memories of it?
It's a funny thing. It became the first of what was going to be a series. So that was 1963. They had one in the summer in Buffalo in 1964. They had one in Berkeley in 1965, and then they didn't have them anymore. It was too bad. But it was, well, there we were, all us young poet guys, in Vancouver, and women, and the teacher Warren Tallman, who is originally from Olympia, actually he's from Tumwater, and he had been a student. He went to university on the GI plan, and he did a thesis on James. And for one of his degrees, and a thesis on Conrad for another one of his degrees. That you'd never think he would. Then he married Ellen Tallman, Ellen whatever her name was, Tallman. And she was a friend of people like Robert Duncan and Lamantia and Michael McClure. And she knew all these people, right? And so she introduced him to all these people, and Don Allen and all of me. He just went snaky. He just suddenly understood what was. Here was something that had been occluded from the normal American, even professor mind, right? It was this magnificent movement of contemporary post-war poetry in the United States, some of it in San Francisco, some in New York, etc. And so he was teaching at UBC, and we all gravitated towards him and his wife because they knew these people, right? And out comes the new American poetry, 1945 to 1960. I'm pretty sure it came out at the end of 1959. We picked that up. And there we were, right? Charles Olson. We'd seen a couple of their books before. Obviously, we'd seen a Ginsberg book, and we'd seen a Kerouac book and a Creedy book before that. But here they all were, right? And we suddenly realized that here's a bunch of people that really made a movement in poetry amongst people, and or three or four movements that are connected together. And that has always been, almost always been the way anything important has happened in poetry in English anyway, and probably, yeah, in French for sure, that like there have been movements, there's been groups. There were the ones around 1915 or 1908 or whatever, you know, the Williams Powell, et cetera, and H.D., et cetera, and there was the English Romantics. They all knew each other, right? And they were all challenging each other and writing each other, and you had Wordsworth and Coleridge. One of them writes the beginning of a poem. The other one reads it, starts writing an answer to that poem. The first guy goes and reads the answer to the poem and finishes his first poem. I did that with Frank Davey years later, but I'm not quite sure.
But Vancouver, 1963. I mean, Olson, well, you're chasing. You're yeah. There thinking. I'm going to chase Charles Olson around wherever he goes,
yeah, right.
And then you hear Ginsberg.
Well, before that, you see, before that we had had Robert Duncan come up. We got together, students who didn't have much money, pulled out all our, some extra money, put it together and bought, can you imagine Robert Duncan, the great American poet, a Greyhound ticket to come all the way from San Francisco to Vancouver. That's like 1,050 miles, right? He came up and he just talked to us for like a week, and he talked to the CBC. Phyllis Webb did an interview with him that went for 9 hours. And so we had that experience, and I'm not sure whether we had had anybody else yet, but we knew who we wanted. And so Warren, what happened in 63 was, it was advertised all over America, and there were actually courses. It was a summer school project. So Olson was a professor, and Duncan was a professor, and Ginsberg was a professor, and Margaret Avison, and Creeley. And then there were some other people who came up as well. And like one person who became a kind of a, who was not there first as a professor, but pretty well became one, was Philip Whalen, although he never got paid for it like these other guys did. So they were giving like 3-week courses. You could take the course and get a mark in it, right? But then there was like lots of readings, people hanging out, lots of drinking, lots of sex, and so forth, parties and everything, right? And like, yeah, and you were right. I said to you that I had said, okay, I'm going to hang around Charles Olson for 3 weeks and really learn how the world is organized. And then I heard Allen Ginsberg recite Shelley. And I just like, went like that. It was like there was an emanation. He had just come back from India with Peter. Like they'd been for 2 years in the Orient, right? And he came like straight to Vancouver. And then when he went home, what he did was they drove up to the Okanagan and crossed in Osuyas in the Okanagan, which is like my old border crossing, right? It's like, what the hell did they think about this guy with this great old Hasidic beard coming down to his waist, right, and curls and everything? And he's wearing robes, right? And probably saying Hare Krishna. What if, oh God, do you have any weapons? But yeah, and so I just followed Ginsberg around. I paid as much attention to the other guys as I could, and there were some magnificent, wonderful, god-awful readings, wonderful readings at that event. Olson gave a 7.5-hour reading, split into two nights, like 4 hours one night and 3.5 hours the next night, right, with one bottle of Cutty Sark per session. He had like this big table with all his manuscripts sitting on it, and he was like reading poems that he hadn't published yet. He read Letter 27 three or four times, and it hadn't been published yet, and Maximus of Dogtown too. And we got so we almost knew those things off by heart, right? It was just great. And Dan McLeod, who later on became the editor of the Georgia Strait, was a brilliant kid for remembering things and learning things off by heart. And Olson read Maximus of Dogtown twice, which I think the poem was about 7 pages long. And Dan heard the tape. Everything was taped. Dan listened to the tape a couple of times and wrote the thing down with the notation the way he thought it was, sent it to Olson. Olson wrote him back and said, you got the whole thing right except for two lines, which is an attestation to Olson's ability to compose and a young poet's ability. This is a kid that was like 19 doing this, right? To read what the guy composed is wonderful. So readings, like Philip Whalen did this reading. And you know, Philip Whalen's pages have got big, huge areas of white space in them. And he observes these when he's reading in those days, right? So he's reading this thing in his very casual Northwest Oregon voice, the writing that he's doing, which is a lot like, I can't remember the other guy's name anyway. So, and then he observes these long silences, and then he reads a couple more words in his silence. And about 3/4 of an hour went by, and this is in a big room that holds about 400 people, and it's like a theater kind of seating with a slope, and he's down at the bottom of the slope. And so he looks up and he says, I guess that's the time. And we said, no, we want you to read some more. So, which we're already, I mean, Olson read 7.5 hours. So he said, okay, those that just can't stand it, right, who cannot get with what I'm doing, like, you can go now. And then they did. About 55-60% of the audience took off. And then the rest of us just all crowded down to the front and hung around him for like about another hour and a half, right? And he wasn't even scheduled to do a reading. You know, he just came up. But there were all kinds of people there then. And there were all kinds of people there then that became like famous poets later on. that we didn't know they were going to become famous poets, but there they were.